Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here with everyone. Well, today I'd like to talk about a topic that maybe you might not have heard a sermon about in a little bit, but it's one that's really interesting for me. Maybe I know most of you might not have heard this sermon, except for the Stewarts that heard it down in Northern Virginia, so they'll just have to pretend like you haven't heard it. But for this topic, in some ways, it seems like it's really simple, and it is on the surface, but just like anything else in the Bible, it's a lot like an onion, where as you start to kind of unravel it layer after layer, you just begin to see just another example of how many layers and how many nuances there are to God and His plan as written about in His Word. Now, I just mentioned that I gave this message in Northern Virginia about a month ago. And it's been really interesting to hear and talk about this with other people, and even with Sarah and I as we went back and forth in the prep for this message, and just really start to understand that the more we get into it, the more that there is to know, especially when it comes to applying this in our lives. Now, my viewpoint about this topic has definitely changed over the years. Since I grew up in the church and Sarah did as well, this was kind of, I don't want to say an unimportant topic, but one that I didn't think about all that much. I never really gave it a ton of thought. It was just always something that my family and I just kind of did, I guess. Now, for some of my friends that only kind of had a basic, high-level understanding of my religion, they thought that this was some kind of Jewish-y type thing that we did, you know, that was kind of weird. Kind of like around the days of unleavened bread, you kind of eat different things, and that's just kind of their deal, and they didn't think that much about it, kind of an idiosyncrasy about our religion. Now, to my friends or acquaintances that did follow their Christian faith a little bit more, this belief seemed quite foreign to them, quite strange as any belief that they had heard of. They couldn't really understand why anyone that would call themselves a Christian would bother to believe in a doctrine such as this. It didn't make sense to them that you would have to observe this commandment today. Now, are there any guesses to what I'm referring to? Well, maybe this clue will give it away. In some ways, this doctrinal belief that we hold true as a fundamental principle to our faith is actually easier to adhere to in Muslim countries than it is in the Deep South, where everything is cooked in lard. Liv, you can hand out the handouts to the young adults. When I gave this in Northern Virginia, I passed out the handouts, and I was like, do anyone know what I'm talking about? And they're like, yeah, you just told us. It's written here on a piece of paper that you handed to us. Well, today I'm going to be talking about the United Church of God's fundamental of belief number 13, which is clean and unclean meats. It's an interesting doctrine for a handful of reasons, some of which we're going to cover today. It's a rare doctrine in that we have instructions to do, but we don't have any explicit instructions as to why. Now, we have some good ideas, of course, that we're going to talk about, but nowhere in the Bible is there a section where it goes through and elaborates why certain animals were considered clean and why certain animals were considered unclean, or why God made the divisions in the way that He did. And while we have the commands to observe this law, of course, there isn't a clear delineation or distinction about when this practice even started or when God created this categorization of food. Now, it's also one of those beliefs that's often met with widespread ambivalence. Now, some of our beliefs, like thou shalt not murder, I think universally people would say that's a pretty good idea. I can get behind that. But if you talk to other people about maybe the nature of God or the family of God, now that would be a hotly contested belief. People would really like to talk to you about that. But if you bring up just clean and unclean meats, you're likely to be met with kind of a, okay. I mean, if you want to, that's fine. Now, but obviously there is a reason why this is one of our core fundamental beliefs. And that's why we're going to investigate it today. Now, before we get started, I'd like to lay down some of the groundwork about this doctrine. I'd like to set this firm foundation, and then we're going to build up from there. So first, I'd like to read our full doctrinal statement from our UCG Fundamentals of Belief, that publication. And I want you to brace yourself for the length of this. It's a little dry. We're going to go through the whole thing, and we're going to come back and break it down. Are you ready? Here it is, quote, "We believe that those meats that are designated unclean by God in Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14 are not to be eaten." That's it. It's actually our quickest and our shortest doctrinal statement that we have in the entire booklet. That's not why I picked it. But don't misunderstand by the shortness of that statement. Just because the wording is short and concise does not mean that it's simple. And it does not mean that this core doctrine isn't one that is rich with meaning and interwoven throughout the entire Bible. And furthermore, this doctrine really strikes at the core of what type of relationship our Creator wants to have with us. And quite frankly, understanding this doctrine is key if we want to see this relationship that God has had with His people throughout time, including us, here today. It's so much more important than simply picking and choosing what to have for dinner. Now, we're definitely going to head to Leviticus and Deuteronomy as we go through the message, but the first time this topic of clean and unclean animals comes up, it's found much earlier in the Bible, as you well know. It's first brought up in Genesis chapter 6. You can turn back there. This is very early in the story of mankind with Noah and the ark, and it's a familiar section of Scripture, but I like to head back there anyway as we start to, again, lay the groundwork behind this doctrine. We're going to pick it up in Genesis chapter 6, starting in verse 17. Genesis 6, starting in verse 17. It says, "And behold," this is God giving instructions to Noah, "and behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh, which is the breath of life. Anything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And every living thing of all flesh you shall bring, two of every sort, into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female." So far, this is very straight, very practical. God wants Noah to construct this ark for the purposes of saving his family and these animals. Now, I'm not a biologist by any stretch of the imagination. I didn't do very well in science, but I know that if you want to save a species, you're going to need at least two. You're going to need a male and a female. But let's drop down to chapter 7 here, verses 1 through 3, chapter 7, because it adds a little bit of a clarification to the instructions. There's an asterisk that is added next to the instructions about some kinds of animals. Genesis chapter 7, verse 1 says, "Then the Lord said to Noah, come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. You shall take with you seven each of every animal." Now, wait a second. What? "A male and his female." We understand that to be seven pairs. "Two of each animals that are unclean, a male and his female. Also seven each of birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of all the earth. For after seven more days, I will cause it to rain on the earth 40 days, 40 nights. And I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have made." And Noah did all that the Lord commanded him. Now, nowhere in the story does Noah pull God aside and say, "I'm with you 100%. We're on the same page. But what are you talking about, clean and unclean animals?" So either Noah already knew what this was all about, or God had communicated this to him in a different way. We don't really know. But there are obviously practical reasons why there were more copies of clean animals. They had to have something to eat within the ark, and they were going to be performing sacrifices after they left. Now, where it was revealed to Noah is not known, but by the time we get to chapter 8 and verse 20, which is after the family and the animals have left the ark and we're back on dry ground, by the time we get to that section, they're offering sacrifices, and it is clear to him what is a clean animal and appropriate for sacrifices and what is not. And this teaching must have continued in some form or fashion after Noah, because all the way until we get to Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14, all mentions of animals for sacrifice or food sources for God's people were animals that were explicitly labeled as clean. We got cows, goats, sheep, doves, pigeons, etc. So it's clear that there's something here, even though it isn't clearly identified yet, what it all means. And whether God taught Adam back when he was naming the animals, or whether it was first with Noah, clear guidance of what was to be considered clean and unclean animals was not codified until Leviticus and Deuteronomy, when God had Moses write it down. And in those cases, we get the nitty-gritty details on what God considers to be the dividing line between clean and unclean animals. So let's head back there to Deuteronomy chapter 14, and let's start to dig in to the details there. But even before we get too deep into this topic, I want to implant a core theme in our minds. Now, I'm going to use this as a reoccurring theme because I think it's very important to keep this in mind, this context, as we go through any list of rules and regulations that are found in the Bible, including those that we're about ready to read with clean and unclean animals. And that theme is this: the Bible is not about rules, it's about relationships. Now, yes, there are rules in the Bible. We're about ready to read a whole bunch of them. The books of Deuteronomy and Leviticus are filled with them, of course. There are lots of rules throughout the Bible, hundreds, maybe even thousands of them. But there's much more to the Bible than just that, isn't there? We have stories. We have poetry. We have prophecy. We have psalms. There are chapters and chapters of genealogies. There are chapters of building details, temple details. There are designs of coverings and priestly garments. Now, rules and commands are very much a core part of the Bible. There's no doubt about that. But that's not the point of the Bible. Instead, the Bible is trying to communicate relationships and relationship principles. Relationships among one another, of course, but chiefly about a relationship with the all-powerful creator of the universe. Because if we approach the Bible as just a set of rules and regulations or a big checklist of do's and don'ts, it's very easy to get lost in the weeds or come away thinking that some are just arbitrary or just random, or that Jesus Christ, when he came in the flesh, just kind of did away with some, or that he modernized them and just eliminated some that were old or unneeded. But if we come at it from a different approach, that the Bible is about relationships, then we start to think differently about a command when it is given. We start to figure out how that changes or how that enhances our relationship with God. So it's with that in mind, then let's start in Deuteronomy chapter 14. We're going to start in verse 1 of Deuteronomy chapter 14. It says, "You are the children of the Lord your God." Again, we're starting with a relationship. "You are the children of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves, nor shave the front of your head for the dead." Now, I'd like to pause here just for a second, and I know what you're thinking. At this rate, we're never going to talk about clean and unclean animals. But there's a reason why we have this foundation. Because clean and unclean meats isn't an isolated concept that can be taken independently from the rest of the Bible. It can't even be taken independently from the rest of Deuteronomy. Let's pay attention to the context of where this target section is. We get a piece of it here in verse 1. And we can definitely get more of a sense of it in Leviticus, but this concept of clean and unclean meats isn't just dropped in randomly. Now, we already see hints where God is saying, look around you. Look at the other nations. See what the other people are doing. See how they're living their lives. What defines them? Because the way you live and the way you interact with your God isn't going to be like that. Our relationship is going to be different. Now, why? Verse 2. "For you are a holy people. For you are a holy people to the Lord. And the Lord has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. Now, God is reaching out and he's carving off a group of people that he has chosen. And this group is going to be different. It's going to be unique. It's going to treat others differently. It's going to worship differently. And it's going to have a unique relationship with God, unlike any other nation before it, and as an example to all the other nations around it. So when you mourn, you're not going to cut yourself. In chapter 13, you're going to handle false prophets differently. In chapter 12, your places of worship are going to be different. In chapter 11, how you teach your children is going to be different. Later in chapter 14, how you handle money is going to be different. In every aspect of your lives, people from around the world are going to look at you and instantly know you are different. Your relationship with God, the God, is different. And starting in verse 3 of chapter 14, you're even going to eat differently. Verse 3, you shall not eat any detestable thing. These are the animals which you may eat, the ox, the sheep, the goat, the deer, the gazelle, the roe deer, the wild goat, the mountain goat, the antelope, the mountain sheep. And you may eat every animal with cloven hooves, having the hoof split into two parts, and that chews the cud among the animals. Nevertheless, of those that chew the cud or have cloven hooves, you shall not eat such as these: the camel, the hare, the rock, hyrax. That's probably the 50th time I've said that, and now I can't think of how to say it. For they chew the cud, but they do not have cloven hooves. They are unclean to you. Also, verse 8, the swine is unclean to you, because it has cloven hooves, yet it does not chew the cud. You shall not eat of the flesh or touch their dead carcass. These you may eat of all that are in the waters. You may eat all that have fins and scales. And whatever does not have fins and scales, you shall not eat. It is unclean for you. All clean birds you may eat, but these you shall not eat: the eagle, the vulture, the buzzard, the red kite, the falcon, the kite after its own kind, every raven after its kind, the ostrich, and so on. Dropping down to verse 19. Also, every creeping thing that flies is unclean for you. They shall not be eaten. You may eat all clean birds. Now, there are even more details in Leviticus, but the core way to determine clean and unclean foods is here. Now, it's very tempting to go through this list and assign motive to the selections. Maybe don't eat pigs because there was no refrigeration back then and it was easier to get parasites, or you don't want to eat shrimp or crabs because they're bottom feeders and kind of nature's garbage disposals, etc., etc. Now, modern science has very much proven that living God's way of life has many advantages, and that if you stick to clean animals and unclean animals, there are rewards for doing that. But that's not the point. It's not about healthy eating habits. It's not like as if God introduced the sexual purity laws so that there would be no venereal disease. Now, that's an obvious and wonderful benefit to living God's way of life, but that's not the purpose behind those principles. Now, let's notice this last verse here, verse 21. Says, you shall not eat anything that dies of itself. You may give it to the alien who is within your gates, that he may eat it, or you may sell it to the foreigner. Now, wait a second. Does God not care about the health and the diet of non-Israelites? Well, of course he does. He's not saying, now you, I don't want you to eat it. I want you to be healthy, but you can just give it to the Canaanite. We don't care about them. Now, obviously not. But a healthy diet is not what this core principle is all about. What is the core principle? Well, continued in this verse, continued in verse 21. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. You are different. God is saying that you are his special treasure. He wants to have a unique relationship with the Israelites. He wants to have a unique relationship with us. He's called them out, us out, separated us and is working with us in a unique way. Clean and unclean restrictions speak more about that relationship than it does about diets. Now, God took from the entire animal kingdom that he created, and he carved out a swath of animals. He took them, and he separated them from the rest. Every time the Israelites were to meal plan, so to speak, it should call into their mind this concept of separation. A group of clean animals that were specifically called out from the rest. And in their own minds, it should refresh that they, as a people, were the same way. A group called out specifically from the rest to have a unique purpose that God ordained. It's a daily reminder for them. Now, I want to zoom out here just for a few moments and come at this from a little bit of a different angle. I want to turn back to Acts chapter 10. Acts chapter 10. Now, this is a section of scripture that some have used in the past to argue that the food laws don't apply anymore, that Jesus came and kind of just did away with them at his death and resurrection. But I want to come at it from this theme that the Bible is about relationships. Now, as we just read, when God was working with the Israelites and solidified a covenant with them, he went through a wide variety of principles to show that they were to be separated from those around them. He gave them all sorts of physical tokens that they could use for this spiritual concept. Now, clean and unclean meats was a way, just one of the ways, that he wanted them to be different so that it was clear that they had a unique and special connection with God. In Acts chapter 10, God was going to work with Peter to help him realize that this relationship, previously one that was exclusive to Israel, was going to open up. And as a result, many more people were going to have access to this relationship with God that was not available to them before. Now, if you took this example from Acts chapter 10 and you took it out of context, though, it sure would seem kind of odd that God would use such a strange metaphor to get his point across. Now, let's revisit this story together. Again, Acts 10, we'll pick it up in verse 1. Acts chapter 10, verse 1. It says, "There was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian regiment, a devout man and one who feared God with all his household, who gave alms generously to the people and prayed to God always." Now, we're going to skip ahead just a little bit, but we should understand here that this man was a Gentile. He was not an Israelite. Now, I think that is clear, but it's important. It also seems that he's a pretty good guy. I mean, he's doing things that he should be doing. He's a good example. And God hears his prayers and tells him to go to Peter. Let's drop down to verse 7. "And when the angel who spoke to him had departed, Cornelius called two of his household servants and a devout soldier from among those who waited on him continually. So when he had explained all these things to them, he sent them to Joppa." Now, here's where the story takes an unusual turn. Verse 9. "The next day, as they went on their journey and drew near the city, Peter went up onto the housetop to pray about the sixth hour." Verse 10. "Then he became very hungry and wanted to eat. But while they made ready, he fell into a trance and saw heaven opened and an object like a great sheet bound at the four corners, descending to him and let down to the earth. In it were all kinds of four-footed animals of the earth, wild beasts, creeping things, and birds of the air." Now, these were unclean animals, as defined in Deuteronomy, as we just read. Verse 13, "And a voice came to him and said, 'Rise, Peter, kill and eat.' But Peter said, 'Well, not so. I mean, no, I've never eaten anything common or unclean.'" In other words, what a strange metaphor. Now, if you were in Peter's shoes here, you'd have to be taken aback, thinking, why in the world would God want me to change a behavior that was integral to who I am? Now, Peter was observing the dietary restrictions just like every other practicing Jew at that time. He never would have considered eating these items. Verse 15, "And a voice spoke to him again the second time, said, 'What God has cleansed, you must not call common.' This was done three times, and the object was taken up into heaven again. So Peter snapped his fingers here and he said, oh, I got it. I can eat anything now. God's made everything fine to eat. Well, no, that's not the conclusion he came to. Now, Peter had to ponder on it for a little bit because he had to put all these pieces together. And right then, as he was thinking about it, this Gentile who was unclean in his mind arrived. And God lets Peter know that, yeah, he indeed had sent him to Peter. And then it all clicks together for Peter. Dropping down to verse 34 and 35, we see it kind of hit Peter all at once, the understanding of a spiritual principle God was communicating. Acts 10, still, verse 34, says, then Peter opened his mouth and said, in truth, I perceive that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, not just Israel now, but in every nation, whoever fears him and works righteousness is accepted by him. Now, I've often thought when reading through this section, like, wouldn't it have been easier if God would have just said, Peter, I'm opening it up to the Gentiles. I don't know if you've ever met Paul before, but he's doing a pretty good job. But I guess that shows a little bit of how my thoughts are lower than God's thoughts. Because by using this analogy, God at once illustrates a much fuller concept to Peter. Peter would have known at once that the reason some animals were clean or unclean was not because of their physical characteristics, like fins and scales, that may be how we identify them, but because God separated them and designated that they were different. Likewise, the reason the nation of Israel had access to this relationship with God was not because of their physical characteristics. It was because God himself carved these people and made them holy and separate. So when God tells Peter, I decide what is clean and unclean, I decide who I'm going to work with, I decide who I'm going to have a relationship with, it would have made natural sense. Instead of making a statement that clean and unclean animals are no longer important, God is using the importance of clean and unclean animals to illustrate a change in a relationship. If Peter only thought about clean and unclean instructions in Leviticus and Deuteronomy as just an arbitrary list of rules and regulations, this analogy would have been completely lost on him. But rather, he understood clean and unclean animals in the context of a relationship that God was creating with his people and how he could, at his choosing, extend it to others. Now, I'd like to add on one other principle of clean and unclean animals today. It's related to the thread that we've kind of been following through, but it has its own nuance to it. And I'd like to head back to the other core area that designates clean and unclean animals, this time in Leviticus chapter 11. You can turn back there. Now, there are so many concepts that are interrelated together that we could focus on. The Bible is truly unlike any other book. I know you know this, but it's so unique in that the themes are so tightly interwoven and connected together. It's truly a remarkable book. Now, I want to start in Leviticus chapter 11 and starting in verse 1. Again, this is the other main section where clean and unclean animals are defined by God. Let's pick it up here in verse 1. It says, now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying to them, speak to the children of Israel, saying, these are the animals which you may eat among all the animals that are on the earth. Among the animals, whatever divides the hoof, having cloven hooves and chewing the cud, that you may eat. Now, the list goes on just like it does in Deuteronomy. We're not going to go through it all, but it breaks down those same characteristics and used to identify clean and unclean animals. Cloven hoofs, chews the cud, fins and scales, etc., etc. Now, there are more details here, though, because it also talks about insects and the like. But I want to drop down to verse 10 here. Still in Leviticus 11, we're going to drop down to verse 10, if you would. It says, but all in the seas or in the rivers that do not have fins and scales, all that move in the water, or any living thing which is in the water, they are, now get this, an abomination to you. They shall be an abomination to you. You shall not eat their flesh, but you shall regard their carcasses as an abomination. Whatever in the water does not have fins and scales, that shall be an abomination to you. And these you shall regard as an abomination among the birds. They shall not be eaten. They are an abomination. The eagle, the vulture, the buzzard, etc. Now, the word abomination is used frequently throughout this context, and it's serious stuff. But what a contrast. Now, if we remember that during and after creation, all of these animals were called good and wonderful, remember? Now, all of a sudden, when put into this context, clean and unclean foods, they are looked at from an exact opposite way. These same amazing creatures are now referred to as an abomination when used in this way. Now, there are fewer, harsher words that are used in the Bible. But it's not just that. In verse 24, we start to kind of pile even more on top. And we switch from simply touching dead animals to becoming ceremonially unclean. And you'll remember, if you're ceremonially unclean, for whatever reason, you had to remove yourself from the people. Verse 39 keeps going, and it adds this. It says, if any animal which you may eat dies, he who touches its carcass shall be unclean until evening. So all of a sudden here, we've gone from eating principles to cleanliness to even just touching normal things in the wrong way. Now, what does all this mean? There's a lot of stuff here for the reader or for the audience at that time to understand. What is the principle that they are trying to get across? Now, remember, we want to filter this by reminding ourselves that the Bible is not designed to be a rules checklist. The Bible has rules, but it's about relationships. So how are all of these separations and distinctions advancing our relationship with God? Verse 44, still in Leviticus 11. Verse 44 says, for I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore consecrate yourselves, and you shall be holy, for I am holy. Neither shall you defile yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth, for I am the Lord who brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. You shall be holy, for I am holy. Now, like we did a little bit earlier, I want to take another opportunity to just kind of zoom out just a little bit to widen our viewpoint a little bit on this individual section of the Bible and just get a feel of the context of the rest of this book. Now, the book of Leviticus is all about separations and delineations between things. Over and over again, God is demonstrating a spiritual concept of holiness through a physical form of separation. God separates the priests. He ordains them, sets them apart. The first handful of chapters in Leviticus are all about sacrifices and separating what God has made holy and how the priests were to interact. Just a chapter earlier, two of Aaron's sons were killed because they did not take this seriously enough. And they did not take it seriously, that separation that God had placed on what was holy and what was not. And they defiled it. They treated it as common and not set apart and holy. Now, anyone can combine something, but only God can separate and make something holy. So this is a difficult concept for us to grasp because we have zero experience with this. We just can't do this. So this is a spiritual principle, and like so many other spiritual principles in the Bible, God lays it out in physical terms so that it's easier for us to understand. For example, in Leviticus chapter 23, that talks about the Sabbath and the holy days. This is a physical separation of time. In Leviticus chapter 27, it talks about tithing. That's a physical separation of our money. Chapter 18 is about sexual conduct and what is separated for use within marriage. Even the little things. Like in Leviticus chapter 19, verses 9 and 10. We read this earlier, but let's go through this. Leviticus 19, verses 9 and 10. Because I want to really notice and really draw down what it says here. It says, when you reap the harvest of your land, You shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. And you shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am the Lord your God. Now this is your land. This is your harvest. This is your vineyard. But again, God is showing a principle of separation. This time, as part of your produce for a purpose that he determined. Now, this is obviously very important to God. This is interwoven throughout the entirety of the Bible. And yet, how easy is it to forget? How easy is it to take something that God has sanctified as holy and treat as common? Now, I think time and time again, when the nation of Israel, when they were listening to instructions and going through different people talking to them, in my mind, I kind of visualized them just standing there and thinking, all right, we get it. Like, do this, don't do that. Got it. Just give me the checklist. We understand. But they didn't understand because it's not about the rules. It's about the relationship. And they weren't really grasping how they were to be holy and separated to a special relationship with God. In Leviticus chapter 10, verses 9 through 11, I'll just read this quick passage. It points out one of the core jobs of the priest was to continually hammer home this principle. Leviticus 10, verse 9 says, "Do not drink wine or intoxicating drink, you nor your sons with you, when you go into the tabernacle of meeting, lest you die. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations." Why? Verse 10, "that you may distinguish between holy and unholy, between unclean and clean, and that you may teach the children of Israel all the statutes which the Lord has spoken to them by the hand of Moses." Instead of working with the people and using these physical examples to demonstrate a holy separation, they chafed at those rules and those regulations themselves. As a result, you can see how they actively worked to break down those walls of separation that God had put up. Not because of the rules necessarily, but because they didn't value the relationship. Now, we're not going to turn back there, but we'll remember that when Israel badly wanted a king so they could be like so many of the other nations around them, remember the story? And Samuel was so depressed, and he was thinking about all kind of the tactical things that a king would do to them, like he was going to take their sons and send them off to war, he's going to take the part of their harvest, demand tribute, et cetera, et cetera. And Samuel was thinking that they were rejecting his leadership. But what did God say? Do you remember the story? He said, "No, Samuel. That's not the point. I separated them. I made them unique. I called them to be my special treasure. I worked to create that relationship with them. They didn't reject you. They rejected me. And they're rejecting that relationship that I wanted to offer them. They did not want to be a holy nation. They wanted to be a common nation, just like all the other ones around them." And it's not just in that instance, of course, but in so many others where they took something that God had consecrated, God had set apart, God had made holy, and they broke it down. They treated the Sabbath like any other day. They treated the holy days like regular days of the week. They treated the tithes and offerings just like any other money. Now, Ezekiel summarizes it in a very succinct way in Ezekiel chapter 22. You can turn back there. I'd like to read it together, Ezekiel chapter 22. We're going to pick it up in verse 23 because this is where Ezekiel really highlights how the leadership was not just wicked and evil, which they were, but why they were wicked and evil and why it caused so much damage. Ezekiel chapter 22, starting verse 23. "And the word of the Lord came to me, saying, 'Son of man, say to her, you are a land that is not cleansed or rained on in the day of indignation. The conspiracy of her prophets are in her mist is like a roaring lion tearing the prey. They have devoured people. They have taken treasure and precious things. Excuse me. They have made many widows in her midst. Now, let's notice this next verse, verse 26. Her priests have violated my law and profaned my holy things. How did they do this? How did they do it? They have not distinguished between the holy and the unholy, nor have they made known the difference between the unclean and the clean. And they have hidden their eyes from my Sabbaths, so that I am profaned among them. Or princes in her midst are like wolves, tearing the prey to shed blood, to destroy people, and to get dishonest gain. Her prophets plastered them with untempered mortar, seeing false visions and dividing lies for them, saying, "Thus says the Lord God," when the Lord had not spoken. The people of the land have used oppressions, committed robbery, and mistreated the poor and needy, and they wrongfully oppressed the stranger. So I sought for a man among them who would make a wall and stand in the gap before me and on behalf of the land, that I should not destroy it. But I found no one. Therefore, I have poured out my indignation on them. I have consumed them with the fire of my wrath. I have recompensed their deeds on their own head, says the Lord God. The leadership mixed everything together. They removed the separation. Nothing was holy. Every man for themselves. They took the carefully crafted principles that God had designed for his people, his own special treasure, and they cast it aside. When they moved away from what God had made holy and what God had made clean, then trouble quickly followed. God sought a man, it says, to make a wall, to stand in the gap. Now, a wall is for separation, to keep the outside out and to keep the inside safe. But God could not find anyone to uphold that separation between holy and unholy, clean and unclean. Now, holiness is such a difficult concept for us to really wrap our minds around. That's why it was so important for the leadership to take those physical examples when they were given and use them to help illustrate a spiritual relationship principle to his people. And once they failed with the physical, of course, the spiritual soon followed. Now, what about us? Can we still use these physical examples of separation that God has laid out and use it to better understand a concept of holiness? Can we integrate it into our own relationships with God? We are his own special treasure too, are we not? Well, in conclusion, I'd like to turn back to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2, I'm going to read verses 1 through 10, and I wanted to close with this passage because it really sums up this doctrine in a way that I'm hoping to get across. But you know, it doesn't mention clean and unclean foods even once. But yet it has everything to do with those principles of what clean and unclean foods is all about. 1 Peter chapter 2, and we'll start in verse 1. Therefore, laying aside all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and evil speaking, as newborn babies, desire the pure milk of the word that you may grow thereby, if indeed you have tasted that the Lord is gracious. Coming to him as a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious. You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Therefore, it is also contained in Scripture, "Behold, I will lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, elect, precious, and he who believes on him will by no means be put to shame. Therefore, to you who believe, he is precious. But to those who are disobedient, the stone which the builders rejected has become a chief cornerstone and a stumbling block and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. They stumble, being disobedient to the word to which they also were appointed. But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Now God looked out across his animal kingdom at the creatures he had created, and he took a subset of them. He carved them out and separated them and designated some as clean and the rest unclean. He told the Israelites that every day, when you think about what you're going to eat, remember the separation as an illustration of the relationship God wants to have with you. And just like God had separated out those animals and made them unique as a physical reminder of a spiritual concept, likewise, he carved out a little group of people from among the great nations of the world and set them apart. He wanted them to be holy, an example to those all around them. He wanted to have a unique relationship with his special people. And when God opened up this special relationship to all mankind, the parties in the relationship might have changed, but the type of relationship God wanted to have did not. Instead of a physical nation called to be separate and unique as a special treasure and a model to the world around, we now have a spiritual family, still called to be separate and unique as a special treasure and model to the rest of the world. We are unique and different to those around us. At least we should be. We are to model the perfect example of Jesus Christ as a light on a hill. And if we start to forget what it means to be a Christian, called and separated, then we have many physical examples to lean on. Be it with the Sabbath, with separated time, be it with tithing, with separated money, and be it with clean and unclean animals, with separated food. Well, brethren, next time you see an unclean screech owl or a vulture on the buffet line, walk right past it. Instead, you can take a double scoop of locusts and crickets, which are clean, and then write a Yelp review that this restaurant is a mess. But most importantly of all, take the principles of clean and unclean meat and let them guide you, not just in our meals, but in every step and in every way as we grow and enhance our relationship with God.